Let us start. Ladies and gentlemen, Your Excellency, dear colleagues, students and friends, it is with great pleasure that we're hosting today the Greek Minister for Labour and Social Security, Dr. Efi Aksioglou, to deliver what is the 17th annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory. Over these 17 years of the annual lecture of the Hellenic Observatory, we had the opportunity to host speakers from across the political spectrum in Greece, from left to right, but also people from civil society, academia, diplomacy, and elsewhere. Often in these lectures, we had, as in many of our other events, the question popped up about the economic model for Greece, the direction for reforms in the labour market and in the economy more generally. So this question was always quite prominent. Today, as Greece has entered a new phase of development after, I would say, very much prolongated economic crisis, and although we're still under the enhanced surveillance within the European institutions, today I think the question of the direction of reforms and the model for the Greek economy and the labour market is even more important. So I think the topic for today's lecture is very appropriate, especially in light of a significant number of reforms that have happened recently in the Greek labour market, but also in light of the very heated discussions that have followed these reforms, both in Greece and in relation to the European institutions. The Minister, Dr. Aksioglou, is very well qualified to talk about these issues, not only ex officio as Minister of Labour and Social Security, and also having participated in the negotiations between the Greek government and the European institutions for many years now. Not only ex officio then, but also very qualified in a professional capacity. Dr. Aksioglou holds a PhD in European labour law and has a background in public law and political science. She has served in positions in the Ministry of Interior in Greece as head of the alternate minister's cabinet and at the European Parliament as accredited parliamentary assistant, while she has also held positions in the university as assistant in the Department of Civil and Labour Law at the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki, where I got my undergraduate degree as well, and as a research associate at the Greek Center for International and European Economic Law. She also has an LSE and Hellenic Observatory connection. During her PhD years, she had the opportunity and we had the pleasure to host her in our biennial PhD symposium. The next edition of this symposium comes this June, I think, 2019. So, but before welcoming the Minister to deliver her lecture, let me make a couple of announcements. The event is video and audio recorded and will be available online as a podcast and video on the Hellenic Observatory website. The event is also live streamed, and for those of you that use Twitter, the hashtag is LSE Greece. I think it's not here, but it is LSE Greece. It is there.
Yes.
Good. Okay, we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers at the end of the lecture, and I hope we'll have a good discussion on what I think is a very important set of issues for Greece. So I'll stop here. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming the Minister to give their lecture.
Good evening and thank you very much. I'd really like to thank the LSE for giving me this, Hellenic Observatory, for giving me the opportunity to have this talk tonight and discuss a little bit about the situation in the country, especially with regard to labour market reforms we have recently proceeded with, but also to discuss all these evolutions under the light or in the scope of the European integration, perhaps in the light of the well-known right now social problem that the European project is faced with. I'd like to thank a lot Vasilis Monastiriotis, who has also helped us a lot during the preparation about the increase of the minimum wage in the country. The increase happened in the beginning of in February, past February, and also Professor Featherstone, whom I remember very well because I've been in the symposiums two times when I was a PhD student, and we had an excellent discussion before where he where he informed me a little bit about the aspects of the Brexit situation right now. Now I'd like to start. I was thinking where I should start from, and I remember that in 2013 European Law Journal published an article that I had written with a great colleague and an excellent professor of labor law in Ireland. The article's title was There Must Be Some Way Out of Here, The Crisis, Labor Rights and Member States in the Eye of the Storm. The article considered the impact of the economic crisis and of bailout deals on the labor law regimes of Greece and Ireland, two of the member states who were most affected by the crisis, and the article analyzed this situation in the broader context of the European project. And I was wondering what has changed ever since me and Michael Doherty, we wrote this article. Many things have changed. My personal involvement in the question. In the meantime, I became a Minister of Labour, so I had to move from an academic question to a question of politics. Other things have also changed, such as the realisation that the social question is the question we cannot escape from. And the UK referendum definitely verifies this. Today, I would like to visit this question, whether there is a way out of there, using the experience that we've gained from the Greek case and my personal involvement to the government. First, let me give you a brief account of the realities in Greece before Syriza came to power. I will give this brief account. I'm sure you are generally very familiar with the situation. And then I'll give an assessment of the state of social and labor rights of Greece in autumn of 2016, just before the Ministry of Labour was placed under my care. Now, from 2010 until the end of 2014, Greece had experienced a GDP reduction by 25%, unemployment exploded to 28%, and unemployment for the youth came around 60%. Inequalities had also exploded. The poorest quarter of the population lost almost 40% of their income. The richest quarter of the population increased their participation by 10%. The population in danger of poverty and social exclusion climbed to 36%, and material deprivation for children climbed to 27%. The recipe prescribed through the two first MOUs until the end of 2014 said that the chronic competitiveness deficit of the Greek economy will be dealt with through internal devaluation, through a reduction in labour costs to be achieved not only by wage cuts but also by imposing general restrictions on labour rights through a, let's call it, organised deregulation of the labour market. In order to achieve this required internal devaluation, there were drastic pay cuts for all public servants and pensioners. In the private sector, there was a quite important decrease of the minimum wage. By a legislative act, the minimum wage was in 2012 cut by 22% and by 32% for the youth, for those under 25 years old. There were mass layoffs, both in the public and the private sector, and there were a number of measures adopted which actually dismantled core elements of the Greek employment protection system, including the suspension of collective agreements, important changes in dismissal law, etc. Now, when Syriza came to power, took office, the urgent goal was to alleviate the major humanitarian crisis that led to the collapse of the Greek society and to pursue the recovery of the economy by reducing the skyrocketing unemployment. By the time the ministry was placed under my care, which was in November 2016, the government had done quite a lot in the field of social protection. We had addressed the humanitarian crisis. The first law that we tabled to Parliament in the beginning of 2015 actually provided for a number of measures to address the needs of people who have fallen below the poverty line: prepaid cards for essential goods, electricity free of charge, rent subsidies. And these measures were then incorporated into a structural reform, the social solidarity income, which is now granted to more than 600,000 people. Before autumn 2016, we have granted universal access of the uninsured to the national health system, and we had proceeded with a with an important reform on the social security system, unifying all funds into one, social security funds into one, and set a safety net from poverty for pensioners. So to sum up, by the time I was appointed, we had taken some important steps to create solid social safety nets for millions of people that had to deal with poverty and social exclusion. However, I would like you to focus on the term that I'm using. I'm talking about social protection, not social rights. The difference lies in the paradigm of the active social citizen versus the socially excluded individual. And let me recall some fundamental truths concerning social rights. First, social rights are not rights of individuals, but of members of the society as a whole. In that sense, they are collective rights. They are rights to participate in the wealth produced within the society and to claim such participation. Second, the core right of social rights is the right to work. And this has two aspects. On the one hand, labor guarantees, or at least has to guarantee, a decent standard of living, and therefore the integration and active participation in social life. On the other hand, at the collective level, labor provides the opportunity of participating in the social dialogue within the context of collective autonomy. As a result, the worker is able to take part in the collective pursuit of social interests in order to transform them into social rights. So coming back to Greek reality, by November 2016, the government had taken important steps in the field of social protection, had not taken by that time important steps in the main field of the ministry, that is the labor market. However, when Syriza came to power, it came to power in order to proceed with a paradigm shift. It set at the epicenter of its strategy for the economy's recovery labor rights and their enforcement. Against the model of internal devaluation, we oppose the model of socially fair and inclusive and sustainable growth, in which wage growth and labor rights are not bottlenecks, but are prerequisites of economic growth. Nevertheless, to implement such a strategy within an economic adjustment program was not easy, for various reasons, among others, the fact that the institutions we were negotiating with, they were very open to discuss reforms in the social protection system. They even had recommended many of them, but they were not open. They were far more reluctant to discuss reforms which would upgrade labor rights, as such acts would seem to or would actually contravene the reverse policies that they had designed and recommended the previous years. So what plan did we adopt, did we follow at the Ministry of Labour? It was a twofold plan. First, we insisted on the restatement of some core elements of employment protection system that had been suspended during the crisis, during the first two programmes, such as collective bargaining. We insisted on the restatement of the basic principles of collective bargaining. But second, we took measures and proceeded with reforms that regulated aspects of the labour market that had never been regulated before. And I mean not even in the crisis period. Aspects that were extremely important for the everyday life of workers, such as to fight undeclared and underdeclared work, both in terms of legislation to set stricter rules where there were none, and in terms of operation, to upgrade the labour inspectorate body to target companies, especially large-scale companies, that used to violate labour law. And the results of this strategy, I believe, are quite satisfactory, although we still have definitely a long way to go. Where do we stand now, both in terms of the reforms as well as of the achievements in the labour market? First, as I have already stated, we have reinstated the basic principles of collective bargaining in the country back in August 2018. So collective bargaining is gradually getting in motion again. We've increased the minimum wage by 11%. We have abolished the sub-minimum wage for the youth. This means that young workers receiving the minimum wage experience an increase of 28%. We have targeted the undeclared and underdeclared work and managed to reduce undeclared work by more than 10 percentage points. We have introduced strict rules on working hours, rules on the protection of wage earners covered by contract work, a new set of rules to reinforce and safeguard labor rights in cases of unpaid work. And today we stand at the point where unemployment has decreased by more than 8 percentage points, and we can safely assume that it will continue to drop as the Greek economy is in a phase of strong and sustainable recovery. The first signs of the labor market after the minimum wage increase are very encouraging. The month the minimum wage was increased, we had a record high in hirings and the creation of new jobs, proving wrong the counter-argument that wage increases could have negative effect on employment. And on this, I would also like to recall the important work that has been done, I believe, by this observatory from Georgiadis and other colleagues, who had a great paper by the end of 2018, which actually said that an increase in the minimum wage would not have a negative effect on employment in the country. And the reality so far verifies this. Now, on other files of the ministry, we implemented a great pension reform. As I said, in my view, one of the biggest reforms that has ever taken place in the country, at least the past decades, where all social security funds are unified into one. We've set one rule, clear rule, to calculate the contributions, one clear rule to calculate the benefits, a new system with redistributive characteristics, but also a new system that really favors those with longer careers. We adopted and implemented a great welfare review. Under fiscal constraints, we increased the budget of social welfare by 3 times and proceeded in important reforms that set the basis for a modern social state. Apart from the social solidarity income, we're implementing policies to fight child poverty, school meals, free nurseries, new set of family benefits, and a couple of weeks ago, a new housing benefit has been introduced, a rent subsidy to support not only the low but also the medium-income households. Thus, we've set the basis for a solid social policy that was never there in the country, not in the pre-crisis period. Now, having said that, I'd like us to try to address these developments within the general framework of the year of the European projects and perhaps see what lessons we can learn from this experience. The fact that the European project is now under serious, not now, the fact that the European project is under serious doubt for more than a decade now, I don't believe that comes as a surprise to anyone. In 2004, the project of European integration was convulsed by the shock of referendum defeats in France and in the Netherlands when the proposed constitutional treaty was rejected. From today's viewpoint, that period, the period that followed that rejection, seems almost like halcyon days. The economic and political crisis that has erupted since 2008 has thrown the very survival of the European project into doubt. The specific economic model, which with various speeds and forms prevailed in the European Union, has eventually produced a widespread public suspicion for the European integration. It has reached a point where for many, greater integration is actually a code for dismantling labor and social rights protected at national level. And the way Europe dealt with economic crisis, mainly through recipes of deregulation of national labor markets, reinforced this public suspicion, engendered this public discontent. And it would be a great slip not to recognize the connection between this situation and the far-right forces coming back to the political front. We are now aware of the fact that public discontent is mainly expressed through the far-right, which casts its shadow over the European project. And actually today we're not only facing the electoral rise of some extreme forces of nationalist and populist far-right parties, we are facing the penetration of xenophobic and chauvinist agenda in the democratic spectrum. And still, traditional political forces at the European level fail to note the relationship between the economic and labor market policies applied and this evolution, which throws the very survival of the European project into doubt. Note this. At the beginning of 2018, the head of states of the southern European Union countries, after the fourth summit, released a common declaration, starting as follows. At the beginning of a year of full economic recovery, after a decade of financial crisis, the EU is back to path of growth. In times of hardship, the Union has developed new governance instruments and strengthened its capacity to react to global challenges. Much has been achieved following a combination of reforms at national level, fiscal discipline and investment. Europe is safer and stronger, but much remains to be done. A more sovereign, social and democratic Europe, which can be a leading model in the world, is our way forward. Together, we can address our citizens' needs by setting a common ambition whilst being open to the involvement of all committed member states, as we have just done in the field of defence. Now, it is true that economic growth has recovered in the EU and key economic indicators have been stabilised. It is also true that the successful steps the Greek economy has taken are also steps for success for Europe as a whole. However, what the declaration fails to note is that the way Europe dealt with the economic and refugee crisis cannot be considered as a success. But on the contrary, it has brought to the fore deficiencies which are of existential nature for Europe. So what can we do if we really want to gain support for the European project, and what can the Greek experience perhaps teach us? If we truly want to target the cause of the far-right rise, if we really want to target the reason behind this public discontent, we need to proceed with a model of a new regulation of the labour market, which would include wage growth. We need to work towards a strategy that combines labour market new regulation with upward wage convergence. I'm talking about new regulation because I believe that we should not be trapped. We should, of course, be in favour of regulation, but we should not be trapped to the concept of restoration. And this is because, first, the concept of restoration may be important for some workers, for some people, for some citizens. But for others, it means absolutely nothing. For the self-employed, for the youth, for the immigrants, for the undeclared. It is also because we face the risk, if we trap ourselves to the concept of restoration, we face the risk of essentially replicating a model that collapsed. So we need a new regulation. And this does not just concern the wage earners, nor does it concern a single state. It concerns the European project as a whole, and it is a prerequisite for the continuation of the European project. We need revolutionary reforms, focusing on those who have a weak voice, both on national and on European level, the youth, the precarious, the immigrants. These are the reforms that will reshape the concept of social rights as political rights in order to emancipate our thought from the constraints that govern, that drive the European integration. And if the recent crisis has something to teach us, is the simple fact that our responsibility is not to defend the past, but to think in an adventurous way about the future, to work on a common strategy that will render visible those that are invisible now, but also those that were invisible in the past, and through the protection of their employment, to make them dynamic agents of modern social rights, the main actors of our political future in Europe. I believe this is the only way the European project can gain democratic legitimacy and support. This is ultimately the only way we can safeguard our common future in Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Minister, before opening up to the audience, is this working? Possibly, yes. Before opening up to the audience, I would like to ask a couple of questions, and please collect your thoughts and start indicating if you want to ask a question. I want to start from the if you want, the last part of your presentation, where you're talking about a new model which includes new regulations, wage growth, and so forth. Can I ask you, what do you think is the main obstacle to, if you want, to developing a set of policies in this direction? Is it the European architecture, the European institutions, you know, the model of economic governance we have at the European level, or is there some sort of, or is it perhaps the fact that we're not 100% sure that we have the answers on the question of how the policy should actually look like? So maybe we think, if you want, you know, old supply-side economics, you know, are not the best guidance, but we do not really have the perfect recipe for the new policy. So is it, if you want, the institutional architecture or the uncertainty we have about the, what is the right policy?
Yeah. No? Okay.
If you can answer that, then it's...
Okay. well, I think that the main problem is that is one step behind. The problem is that we have not yet realized, at least not the traditional political forces, have realized that there is a connection between the public discontent with the labor market policies and economic policies that have been applied in the European Union. They have not realized that there is a connection between this public discontent and the rise of the far right, of the extreme far right forces in the European Union. They still fail to note this event, this evolution. And if we fail to know that, we cannot understand that there is a reason, that there is something that we need to change. And I see that the European Union, at least the European Commission, the councils of ministers, they continue business as usual. They have not seen what has happened the past 8 years in the European Union, what this wave of public discontent has emerged, and it is getting huger as the time passed by. So I believe that the Europe, and in order to answer your question, whether, so it's definitely not the uncertainty of policies, because we have not yet agreed, at least traditional political forces, they have not yet agreed that there has to be a change, there has to be a shift of the policies that are implemented. There are some barriers by the way that the European Union architecture is, but I do not believe that these are decisive, because right now we have steps upon which we can build such a strategy. For example, in November 2017, we had the pillar of social rights of the European Union. All the heads of member states, they were gathered in Gothenburg, and they signed the new pillar of social rights for the European Union. So there are documents with the legal gravity that we would want them to be, such as the Charter of Fundamental Rights, that is ever since 2009, I believe, has the same legal force as the treaties. So there is ground upon which we can build this policy. The problem is that we have not yet agreed that there is a connection, a cause and a result in this situation.
Okay, thank you very much. One more question, then I'll open to the audience. I was kind of part of a discussion, because you mentioned so the latest stages of your reform strategy includes also sort of interventions in the social security funds, and there is this debate about the second pillar and the privatized second pillar with occupational pensions. And there's a very good argument, or a very straightforward argument for why one should have, if you want, quasi-privatized occupational pillars. In some way, this is kind of the standard in many, or the direction of travel for many countries. And we know in Greece there are problems also with state funds and the regulations they have with the management of the reserves. Do you think this is something which is necessarily part of a new model for the labor market or for the economy, as you were saying? Why can it not be with privatized occupational pensions?
Well, firstly, the debate that there is in Greece concerns a different proposal than the one that you described right now. The main thing that we have to bear in mind when we are discussing about the pension system in Greece is that current contributions pay for current pensions. So if we take current contributions out of the public fund and we invest it like to private funds, I'm taking the whole picture, then the state will not be able to pay the current pensions. There is a problem. It's not a problem. This is actually the formation of many pension schemes in Europe as well. So we cannot take the contributions right now. We cannot give the possibility to take the contributions right now out from the public fund and invest them to private funds, because this would create directly a problem in order to pay current pensions. We have number two. Occupational funds are totally different from private security funds. Occupational funds are non-profit, actually, funds. They are governed by a body of co-governance of employees and employers, and they have a very specific regulation which is supervised by the Ministry of Labour. So they have a very specific way they function. And of course we have no, me personally nor the government has any problem with occupational funds, not at all, which could work in parallel with the first pillar, which is the public fund. The problem comes with the private funds. Of course it is within the everyone's choice to have a private fund as well, but I mean additionally. Because otherwise I described the problem that would be with the pension system. However, those who support the private funds fail to note, I believe that they do it intentionally, is that the contributions that are paid to the private fund are under investment risk. And I believe that the insured should know that it's not that I put my money in a bank and I find them when I get 70 years old and they are all grown up. There is an investment risk, and unfortunately in Greece we had extreme cases in the previous years where private funds really collapsed and people lost the fruits of a lifetime. So I think that all this should be open to the public dialogue, so everybody knows what is really happening.
Thank you very much. Opening to you. Can I please ask you to identify yourselves and keep the questions short? We'll start with the question over there.
Hello. So my name is Dimitrios Kivotidis and I'm a lecturer at the University of East London. But please allow me to make a couple of comments on behalf of the Action Committee of the Greek Migrants in London. I want to thank the Minister for this self-congratulatory presentation, but I'm afraid that the Minister only used the brightest of colors to illustrate the picture of the current situation in
Can you keep
Greece
your comments to the next 20 seconds and then ask the question?
I will try to keep it very brief, and there are questions.
18 seconds.
The reality is much darker. Indeed, it is a reality of increased exploitation, fear, uncertainty, precariousness, and bullying practices by employers. For example, the minister mentioned minimum wage. However, she forgot to mention that behind this raise, we find the activation by the Syriza government of one of the worst anti-workers laws of the memoranda, a law which prohibits the minimum wage from being determined by collective bargaining. Instead, minimum wage is now determined by a ministerial decision based on the exigencies of the economy, that is, the needs of capital. So what is to stop future governments from reducing the minimum wage even further in the event of a new recession? Or do you think that this is unlikely to happen? Or is it a coincidence that the government rejected the legislative initiative of 530 trade unions for a minimum wage at €751 and the abolition of all anti-labour legislation? Second, the minister mentioned the reduction of unemployment. However, this reduction of unemployment is mostly associated with the incredible increase in part-time and temporary contracts. In 2018, 55% of workers were hired under part-time contracts. And of course, the minimum wage for a worker on a part-time contract is much less than 650 okay. euros.
Thank you. So let me summarize your question. You can sit down. Thanks.
Last question. How does the restriction of the exercise of the right to strike fit within this whole scheme that the minister so proudly presented? Lovely.
So the right to strike, the unemployment picture is more about casual employment, and then the minimum wage increase still is anti-worker. We'll take a second question here from the front here, and then you can.
Yeah, Bernard Casey, sometime of this house and sometimes of somewhere else. I wanted to ask about labour protection. You suggested that there were efforts to improve labour protection, and you pointed particularly to standards in large enterprises. The problem with Greece is that an awful lot of Greece is small enterprises, and one suspects that there is an awful lot of relatively undeclared labour, relatively undeclared wages in this sector, and relatively undeclared conditions. So I wondered whether you could comment upon the impact of reforms and changes, not only on what we see in the statistics, but what is actually going on in the ground. Because in particular, we do know that, and my experience from the past has been that Greek labour statistics, Greek social protection statistics have been extremely questionable. And so do we really know what is going on? And do we really know what is going on in this small firms sector in particular?
Thank you. If you would like to take this question.
Okay. First of all, I would like to underline that I never said, and I would never say, at least as long as I'm a minister, that I'm satisfied with the situation of the Greek labour market. Definitely not. I have described how many steps have been taken, and of course, as I underlined during my presentation, there are so many steps to be taken from now on. Now, on the three issues about the minimum wage, it is true that until 2012, the minimum wage in the country was defined by a national general collective agreement, that is, through collective bargaining by the national social partners. And then this changed, and ever since there is a law that provides that the minimum wage is set by a ministerial decree after an agreement of the cabinet and after a ongoing, there is social dialogue involved, but it is not in the decision of the social partners. There is also a committee of experts. Vasilis was a member of this committee the committee sees the basic economic indicators as well as how long the minimum wage has been frozen, for example, in the country and another indicators. And they come up with a proposal. The minister can agree with the proposal or not, and in the end there is a ministerial decree. What we did in our case, my government is in favor of the competence getting back to the social partners, to be accurate. And that's why the parliamentary group of Syriza has proposed a constitutional review in which this will be safeguarded in the constitutions, that the social partners will define the minimum wage level. However, I have strong beliefs on that, that immediately after exiting the program, it was an urgent need for the country to have an increase in the minimum wage and not get into a whole discussion about changing the system. But we immediately needed to increase the minimum wage exactly because it has been cut in 2012 by 22% and it has been frozen ever since. There was a great need for the working population to have this immediate increase. And then we can proceed with changes in the regime if, of course, is also this something to be accepted within the constitutional review. However, I do think that 11% is is a significant increase for the working population. Of course, much more needs to be done, but it's a good first step. And I surely think that the abolition of the subminimum wage was also, for the youth, was also a very important step to take. Now, on the reduction of unemployment, there are many surveys which show different results about unemployment in the country. The most accurate one, actually, is the one that is depicted by a database in the Ministry of Labour, database called EGANI. This is the most accurate one because, actually, every year the firms are obliged to declare how many workers are there in the company, and this actually can depict whether we have a good evolution from one year to another. So the decrease of the unemployment that is described by 8% is accurate. More than 307,000 jobs have been created since the beginning of 2015. And now, about whether these are part-time or full-time employment, the new jobs that have been created in 2018, for example, there were 70% full-time and 30% part-time. So it is not accurate that the mix of part-time and full-time employment is against the full-time employment. The total picture of the labor market is that part-time employment still is more than full-time, but the new jobs that are created after 2017 are in favor of full-time employment. So this shows that we are moving towards a good direction. Not that we have achieved the exact the total change of the picture, but we are moving in the right direction. Now, on the right to strike, the change that has passed by the Parliament refers to quite a very specific issue that concerns the first-level union organizations. And it the change provides that in order for a union to agree to decide for a strike, there has to be 51% of the members of the trade union who are present to vote in favor of the strike. We had various discussion on the issues before, but the reality shows that ever since the law passed, there were some loud voices saying that this would really set a barrier to the right to strike. This would limit essentially the right to strike. But the reality shows, ever since the law passed the Parliament, that there's actually no change in the right to call a strike by the trade unions. Strikes are still a reality in the country as it used to be before. Now, going back to the second question about the, if we really know what is going on about the small and the large-scale enterprises, well, what we thought was the case was that delinquency and violation of labor law and undeclared work mainly concerned very small and small enterprises. What we realized through the Labour Inspectorate body and the controls that we are implementing showed that this is mainly the case of large-scale enterprises, and especially the banks. The banks were a field in which working hours were never actually respected. They were never declared for overtime work. Workers were never declared for overtime work. They were never paid for overtime work. So we targeted large-scale enterprises, and that's how we got an important decrease of the percentage of undeclared work by 10 points, as I said. But we also set some very strict rules on working time. We actually obliged the firms to declare the working time before the overtime, before it is actually worked by the workers. And this change, this small change, had quite an important result. Within 1 year, the hours that the working hours that have been declared by the firms have been three times up. So it seems that all these working hours were lost in the past, were not declared, they were not paid, and they are now declared and paid if it's overtime or you know, the worker can go back to its home when the working hour is the 8 hours are over. So this is quite important because these are the kind of changes I was talking about previously, that these were the dark spots of the past, I mean the pre-crisis period, that we never dealt with and that we are now dealing with, and I believe it has a result in everyday life of workers.
Okay, we'll take some more questions.
Hi there. Theo Ventopoulos, UCL. Thank you for the talk, first of all. It was really interesting. And following up the part-time discussion you had before, recently I got involved in a research with a colleague of mine in the finance ministry. We got access in Elstat data about the manufacturing sector. And it was interesting because I got checking the data, and I've seen that more the number of workers in the part-time workers is larger since from 2008 till 2013 than the full-time workers. So I'm curious, what was the structure like of the industry before the crisis? So is it something that it used to be like this, for example, manufacturing, that I've seen like a lot of part-time workers because employers prefer them before the crisis as well? Or is it something that actually occurred because of the crisis and you ended up with this problem when you become a government and you're trying now to solve it? Thank you.
Okay, can we get the question from the man next to you?
Yeah, hi. My name is Paris and I'm a design researcher. There's a big discussion here in the UK about reducing the working week. So we have the opposite problem here. So there was a report recently that came out, supported also by members of the Labour Party. One of the big arguments is that working many hours doesn't guarantee productivity, and Greece is mentioned as an example. I think we're working the most, like whoever has work, right, works the most hours in Europe. So I have two questions on that. First, why do you think that's the case? Why we're not productive enough? And the second one is maybe your personal opinion about these, you know, more utopian ideas about reducing the working week without cutting payment, of course, and also things like universal basic income or services.
Easy questions.
Okay. About the composition of the employment relations before the crisis in the Greek labor market, the truth is that the composition was in favor of full-time employment. So before the crisis, of course, there were flexible forms of employment, but the composition was always in favor of full-time employment. The important change happened in the crisis. So I believe it is more a result of the crisis, not actually a basic characteristic of the Greek labor market or of the needs of the firms. And this is why I think it is changeable, exactly because it was related, this change against full-time employment happened within the crisis, so it seems that it can change gradually, and that's what the numbers show us for the years after 2017, when the economy started to have a good growth pace. About productivity, but I believe, I don't know, I'll say a couple of things, but I don't know if I'm correct, because he's a labor economist next to me, and I'm a little bit anxious. There is an issue about productivity, and this was a debate with the institutions as well. The institutions were arguing that because there is not an important increase in the productivity, we should not proceed with an important increase in the minimum wage. So we never actually discussed numbers, but I think that they would really like us to be like around 2%, and we proceeded with an increase of 11%. because they were seeing the numbers and they saw that we didn't have an important increase in productivity in the country. However, in Greece, productivity is mainly demand-driven. For example, you can see a small coffee shop in 2010 with two employees, and they had a productivity like making 20 coffees per day. And then you see the right next year, in 2011, they make 10 coffees per day. Is it possible that they lost their productivity or something so weird happened to their life that they cannot be as productive as previously? No. The answer is that demand has dropped. So in case of the Greek labor market, demand is a very key parameter in productivity because we have a very small enterprises in which demand plays a crucial role in the outcome. And this was major debate with the institutions. The fact that you said that reducing the working hour is a utopia, I think it touches upon exactly my talk that we should think about adventurous ways. That's exactly what I'm talking about. It's not about always talking about reinstatement, restoration. Of course, there are basic principles that should be restored, but this is not the answer to the problem of the time. Yes, I believe that reducing the working time per week is one of the steps that we should again start talking about, because in France, I believe before the crisis, there was this discussion, then we left it behind. I think we should reopen this discussion, yes.
I was smiling when you mentioned the productivity issues, because this debate exactly was appeared in the report that we published on and the recommendation on the minimum wage, so at least you read the report. There's evidence for that. This is very good. More questions? The lady here.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Minister, for being with us. I wanted to ask you a question about one aspect of the EU's policy towards Greece that kind of, I guess, was one of the more innovative features of the EU's policy. And I'm talking about the hands-on kind of technical assistance and technical support that the EU started to provide to the Greek authorities, kind of realizing that, you know, the very weak administrative capacity of the state was one barrier towards implementing certain structural reforms. So I wanted to ask you a bit what has, like, from your experience working with the Task Force for Greece and its kind of its successor, the Structural Reform Support Service, on things like the pension reform that you talked about or the implementation of the guaranteed minimum income. How has your experience been with that cooperation? Has this been something helpful? Is this something that the EU should replicate also in other countries? Is this a way to provide kind of hands-on useful support to countries with weak administrative capacity? And how could the system work even better in the future?
Would you like to take this question?
Well, there isn't one answer to this question, and I'll tell you why, at least from my experience. Technical support, when it has as a result reports, this cannot always be a parameter to solve problems. For example, when many of my colleagues were positioned ministers, they said we found on our desks numerous reports. What are we going to do with all these reports? So it is the case that many times technical support in the country, even before the MOUs, went to waste. Because the issue is to identify the problem and identify what is exactly the support you are looking for. Now, in the ministry, for example, I know that technical support for the guaranteed minimum income or the social solidarity income was very useful. Indeed, they helped us in designing. They were also very surprised that we took some steps forward, and they copied these steps in order to have a best practice for other countries, etc. The technical support in pension reform did not work at all. So we needed a very specific help in, for example, for arrears clearance, for very, very specific problems. We didn't have the support we needed. On the other hand, the European Commission on the pension reform was very helpful, I mean, in the discussion during the negotiations, because it's something that we wanted to do, they wanted us to do, and we had very fruitful discussions. So it varies from situation to situation. It has to do with whether you have identified what problem exactly you need to solve. At some point, you just need more hands, more public servants, more more technical support, more IT systems. Not so much a report to prove the right or the wrong direction of the reform.
Okay. There's another question on this side here at the front.
Thank you very much, Vicky Price. We're in a country here where minimum wage is actually also set centrally. And the interesting thing is that in the Brexit debate, you talked about the concerns you have about the sort of liberalization, deregulation of Europe. In fact, our unions are seriously concerned that workers' rights will diminish as a result of us leaving Europe. So there's a completely different view of what Europe does. So I'd quite like a little bit more on that, if possible. The second thing is in relation to the improvement in employment that has taken place. There's been a lot of exodus of young people, so there's been big migration taking place. To what extent has that contributed to this? And of course, brain drain, which is very bad for productivity, innovation, the economy, and so on. And then finally, again, if you look at other countries like here, the increase in employment we've seen recently, in the last few years, has to a considerable extent relied on the over 50s actually going back to work or continuing to work. There is a very strange thing in Greece, which is that if you're receiving a pension and you go to work, then your pension is cut. It doesn't happen in this country. Does this discourage people from going into work and discourage people from contributing to the economy a lot more, which actually should be having quite a considerable positive impact? I think it's the only country where I know this to happen, and it seems very, very peculiar.
Questions, so if you would like to.
Well, it's right what you said about the trade unions, but at the same time, the trade unions were much more in favor of the European integration before 2006, and they've started changing their minds. I'm not saying they want to leave the European Union, because in the end, when they face two risks, one risk or the other risk, they decide to take the one with the minimum cost. But that's not a support for their European integration. It's not support. There is a public discontent, and it's going through the trade unions as well, that the deeper the union, the deeper the integration, the more the labor rights will be dismantled. This does not mean that everybody will tomorrow vote in favor of leaving the European Union. For example, we have a referendum in Greece and everybody will say, let's go out of the European Union or in other countries. But this at the same time, does not mean that they support it. There is another parameter for that. I hope I do not become very lawyered now. And there were a number of decisions of the European Court of Justice when the European Court of Justice had to decide between in a collision of a labour right with an economic freedom, it always had a decision in favour of the economic freedoms. And there were many trade unions that were very annoyed of this evolution, because they realised that in fact every labour right in the end can set a barrier to an economic freedom. Okay, if you have the right to strike, can always be a barrier to the economic freedom. So if every time the scope that the court sees this collision is from the point of view of the economic freedom, and the court says, I do not want any barrier to the economic freedom, then in the end, this will always result in to the detriment of the labor rights. So I think that the public discontent is there. I think that yesterday I was in a taxi and I heard, in the radio, a woman saying about Brexit and she was saying, why would we want to remain in the European Union? It just makes the rich richer and the poor poorer. This phrase, a simple phrase, is exactly the point of the public discontent, the idea that has gone through the society right now. Of course, there are many other aspects. The idea is that this formation, the European integration, this project, initially did not help us as much as we thought it will. But okay, but from one point onward, it made things worse for us. We've lost wages, we've lost rights, we've lost jobs. So you see, I think that the strategy needs to be more. I think that we should not adopt this defensive point of view that the trade unions do not say, let's go out to the European Union. Yes, but they do not support it as well.
If I can interrupt here and just a follow-up on Vicky's point, I think the point was that seen from this country, the European Union looks quite worker-friendly. And the concern is that leaving the European Union means that you're going to have a regression in terms of employment protection, definitely for working hours. We already have the opt-out, but still. So worker rights, seen from this perspective, are protected by the European Union rather than being attacked by the European Union. So how can we then justify people in the continent seeing Brussels as the place where, you know, sort of the vehicle for attacking?
Seeing from the point of view of many other member states, it is definitely the regulation that is prescribed. Take, for example, leave aside the issue of the normal functioning of the European Union. What was the recipe that was prescribed to the countries that were in crisis? Portugal, Greece, Ireland. Definitely a recipe of organized deregulation, however. And there was a philosophy behind it. It was not weird thought. It was the philosophy that if we make the labor market more flexible, I've come against this view many, many times. If we make the labor market more flexible, this will create new jobs. The outsiders will become insiders. It's very, very widely known opinion about how the labor market should work. And in the end, this did not. This produced many negative results. It produced a general disbelief in the project. And the European Union was behind it, because in the end it was the European Commission who was presented, at least in the negotiations with the governments in the various member states. So I believe that we should start discussing in the European Union about a common strategy that would include upward convergence, not deregulation, new regulation and upward convergence on wages as well. Now on brain drain, whether it's still a problem, it is still a problem in the country in the fact that it has not transformed into brain gain, which means that although we managed to stop this movement of young, well-educated people to going abroad, we have not been able to reverse it, so allow them to come back or give them incentives to come back. Now, we've taken some steps, however. From 2015, for example, public spending on research has increased from 0.8% of GDP to 1.2% of GDP. The public spending right now is higher than ever before in the country, than even the pre-crisis period. It may sound way too low for you, but for Greece it is quite a change. 1,000 new jobs for professors have been created, and for young researchers at the Greek universities, after 7 years of no action in the field. And we've created in 2016 a Hellenic Foundation for Research and Innovation, which is also, it has started working a little bit, producing programs for PhD students and for postdoctoral students. and a new framework in order to give more incentives for research. So these measures still need time to work in order to reverse this movement, but I believe that they are important steps, at least for the time being. Bear in mind that we were in country with a sharp reduction in GDP and consecutive years in the programs of economic adjustment, of fiscal constraints, extreme fiscal constraints. Now, you said a specific issue about, yes, it's true that those who receive a pensioner who goes to work has a pension cut of 60%. And this was a measure recommended, I'm using very nice words, by the Troika. They insisted on this a lot, saying that when you have a labor market with such high unemployment, you should create these incentives for pensioners to keep working, to keep, you know, occupying positions of employment. I wouldn't support right now this philosophy, but then again, we should make priorities given the very specific fiscal space that we have right now. We should make our priorities.
There was a question.
Thank you. Horan Voskerisin from Berkeley College. You know, in Greece there is a huge representation gap, as we say, so huge numbers of employees are not being represented by trade unions directly, and this is due to the structural problems of Greek capitalism and the structural problems of trade unions. But going back to your point and some of the questions that have been heard in this room, in this category of people, in these demographics, we observe quite a lot of inequality, quite a lot of undeclared work and employment and so on. And what I was wondering was whether there is some space there for the legislator to intervene in order to create the environment, let's say, the state where these people that are underrepresented or not represented at all can have a voice eventually in the workplace. Thanks.
Shall we take another question?
Yes. Well?
Yeah.
Need to think
like yeah. Okay. I think there was a question at the very back.
I would like to ask on a personal level, how would you deal with the fact that probably most of the questions you have to deal with are outside of Greece's powers? If the economy goes well, labor, you know, market is going to do better. But I would argue the powers that are in play here are bigger than Greece or even the EU, like the public discontent, I would argue, is not towards the EU only, it's towards capitalism. And I work at a bank, so I'm not saying that because I'm a communist. And second, structurally, capitalism is aggregating wealth to the people who have the means to invest, so it's not such a simple question. Also, Italian banks go down. The first thing that will go down after them would be Greek banks. So again, that throws labor market out the window. And also, last but not least, China. Anyone who has worked with Chinese people knows that they don't have very much interest in having work-life balance. They work round the clock. How do you compete with that? China is buying assets in Europe all the time.
Okay, shall we keep
you
it?
You have to compete with that. So basically, on a personal level, how do you
cope?
How do you keep trying and keep being hopeful? And on an institutional level, how does the EU answer to that?
Well, on the first question, Horen, about the the fact that many workers are not represented actually in Greece. It's true that we have very, very low union density in the country, and it gets worse as years go by. It seems that the workers are losing faith in trade unionism. And this is a result, of course, of the policies that have been implemented in the country, but it is also a result of the trade union movement in Greece, which is not in a good state. And it definitely persuade a young worker to organize himself or herself in a trade union. Now, whether the state could intervene in this situation, well, in the Greek constitution, the trade union freedom is guaranteed, and this means actually that the state can only regulate very broadly the way that the workers are organized, but the state cannot intervene in everyday life of trade unions, and this is a good thing in principle. And we should keep in mind that we should be sure about the autonomy of the trade union movement. However, I do think that we should work on this direction about giving the possibility for a greater role of first degree unions to participate in the dialogue, in the social dialogue, in the social formation. Currently in Greece, there is a third level trade union organization, one. There is not much worker support on this third union level. Third level union, and in the end it's the only union that can participate in the social dialogue. From my experience, this third level union did not actually help in promoting labor rights the past years through the crisis. We were very often found ourselves in the ministry to do their jobs, actually. Many times I had the employers' unions against me, and me or my colleagues, you know, dealing, negotiating, conflicting, etc. And the workers' union just stood there and did not say a word in many, many occasions. In many, many occasions. And this is definitely not a good sign of how things should progress in the labor market. It should not be the state they want to do to take the role of the third level union organization in the country. So I do believe that we should find ways to enhance labor rights of workers at the first level unions. But before that, even if we take a step back, I think that first we should try to make the invisible visible, in the term that we should be able to guarantee working positions and guarantee some basic rights, such as to make the undeclared workers declared, to bring them to the fore, to make sure that the precarious workers in the banks have the same rights as the other, to make sure that young workers have the same rights as the other, so to bring them in the same line, to bring them to the fore, and at the same time discuss about collective labor rights as well. Now, on the second question, no, I think that policies do matter. Policies do matter. It's not the same thing. It's not. Of course, the situation is influenced by the way the economy is growing or not, by the way the spreads are going or not, are going well or not, but policies do matter. Take, for example, the case of Greece. We had a government in 2012 that within one night cut the minimum wage by 22%. It created the subminimum wage for the youth, so a cut by 32%. It proceeded with major changes in dismissal law, cutting the compensation for dismissal. It suspended collective bargaining in the country. It worked in a way that exploded the unemployment to 28%. And currently there is a government that increased the minimum wage. Unemployment is decreased. The sub-minimum wage has been abolished. The undeclared work is falling. A number of rules have passed by the parliament to regulate the labor market, to set strict rules on working time. For example, another rule that I didn't mention is that in cases of a firm going bankrupt, the workers are considered privileged creditors, so they are the first to be compensated. These are, in my view, these are important steps, because these steps concern everyday life of hundreds of thousands of workers in the country. I cannot consider that it's the same situation than before. And this is, from a personal note, the thing that gives us hope. For example, we receive emails saying that after we pass this law for working time, young workers in banks get home by five o'clock, and they are very, very happy. They say, "What's this labor inspector do? What is this thing? We like to thank this thing that we do not know it existed." So this gives us hope, of course.
Okay, I think we have just about time for one more question. No, okay, all right. So. Very good timing then. I would like to make another announcement before we close the proceedings. So our next event of the next event of the Hellenic Observatory is on the 2nd of April, 6:30, same time, same room, I think, Hong Kong Theatre, yes. 2nd of April, we have a panel with Yorgos Kaminis, the Mayor of Athens, Maria Georgiou, Professor of Media Communication, talking about Athens grassroots regeneration, reflections from Mayor George Kaminis. 2nd of April, same room here. Well, Minister, it was really a pleasure to listen to you. Thank you very much for the presentation, but also the extensive discussion in the Q&A. Please join me in thanking the Minister.